you are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
Welcome to the Director Series Podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
With the successful completion of Interstellar in 2014, director for Christopher Nolan had seemingly conquered the outer limits of cinematic possibility, in a technical sense as well as an artistic one. He had started as an upstart indie kid with a scrappy, no-budget feature shot on the streets of London. And now here he was, firmly into middle age, with a deep bench of ambitious and well-received studio efforts that established him as one of the most successful and highest-grossing filmmakers of the 21st century. Despite all of his staggering accomplishments, Nolan was not content to rest on his laurels. He still hungered for artistic growth and technical challenge. The question of his next move would be answered with sensible yet somewhat surprising developments: a short documentary about one of his formative influences, and an ambitious war picture that would disregard the sprawling narratives of his recent work in favor of a razor-tight precision. These two works, 2015's Quay and 2017's Dunkirk, find Nolan at a point of recalibration, an experimentation with his artistic identity in a bid to avoid the creative stagnation that affects so many filmmakers at the heights of their success. While they don't evidence a major reinvention of Nolan's aesthetic, Quay and Dunkirk nevertheless signal the director's rededication to present tension, to capturing the drama of life in all its visceral immediacy.
You couldn't be sure that it would be absolutely precise. I think that's what we enjoyed, was that even when you rewound and you did the dissolves, they were rough and ready.
Yes.
I don't think we ever tried to make a sublime dissolve.
As a noted champion of practical effects and technical craftsmanship, Nolan has a vested interest in supporting similarly minded filmmakers. As the director of some of the biggest blockbusters in recent memory, Nolan also has the power to shed light on underexposed voices by using the pedigree of his own name to help them find a new audience. In 2015, Nolan did just that for the Quay brothers, two masters of imaginative puppet animation celebrated for a handcrafted gothic aesthetic that's less Walt Disney and more David Lynch.
The more we get pushed into a corner, the more you can also find hidden forms, hidden architectures.
The 8-minute Quay is Nolan's first documentary effort, and the first short he's made since 1997's Doodlebug. Working with co-producer Andy Thompson, Nolan essentially acts as a one-man crew like he did on his debut feature Following, serving as director, producer, cinematographer, and editor as he documents the Quay brothers giving a tour of their cavernous shop and their myriad creations. Ever true to his purest approach towards celluloid cinema, Nolan shoots Quay on 35mm film in the 1:85:1 aspect ratio, conforming his high-contrast, desaturated earth tone aesthetic to a handheld observational tone. Nolan is content to simply let the Quay brothers riff on the nature of their work, without inserting himself into the conversation or imposing any sort of contrived narrative, ultimately creating an intimate portrait of two artisans and the lo-fi, handmade artistry behind their inimitable body of work.
Smaller beam could give it an eye lighter. Try to get mirrors where everything is coming off the back.
Quay screened at the Film Forum in New York before being made available on a boutique Blu-ray release collecting several of the brothers' iconic shorts. Nolan's reverence and appreciation for the Quays is palpable. There's no question he regards their work as a formative influence on his own approach to filmmaking. Of course, the Quays were renowned long before Nolan turned his lens on them, and didn't necessarily need a documentary like Quay to expose their work to a wide audience. But the film does, however, reach a different audience, the kind whose diet consists only of mainstream Hollywood spectacles and isn't particularly inclined to seek out the eccentric deep cuts of indie animation.
It was just the two of us and this beautiful machine, frame by frame, you complicitly work. A lot of the Hollywood Mitchells were used by the animators because they were beautiful for their mechanisms.
In showing us a key influence in his advocacy for practical effects in the face of digital wizardry, Nolan reveals a deeper insight into his own artistic character, while suggesting the beginning of a more intimate and experimental phase in his professional development. Along with the mass devastation and the loss of millions of lives, World War II brought about something positive, a recognition of the innate heroism in every person. It wasn't just a conflict fought by unseen generals and soldiers on some distant field. It was a harrowing ordeal that quite literally hit home for countless civilians around the world. The European theater in particular saw no shortage of battles play out within the confines of its urban centers. No one could say their personal lives weren't directly affected by the war. When we hear about stories of courage in combat, we tend to remember these episodes with a veneer of romanticism, and rightly so. World War II is often painted as a necessary good war, in which the forces of freedom and righteousness waged battle against the evil and inhumane virtues of fascism for the soul of the 20th century. However, the people actually living these episodes of courage, soldiers and civilians alike, most likely didn't view their experiences through the rose-tinted glasses of nostalgia. Indeed, many of these courageous moments were a result of terrified men and women simply trying to survive. This sentiment, a complex fusion of bittersweet heroism, desperate self-preservation, and corrosive survivor's guilt, drives Nolan's 10th feature film, Dunkirk. Structured less as a conventional war film and more like a harrowing survival thriller, Dunkirk recreates the evacuation of Allied forces from the eponymous coastal town in France as an awe-inspiring story of unfathomable courage and frenzied survival, despite the event itself serving as a tactical loss for the good guys. This snatching of an emotional victory from the jaws of strategic defeat is precisely the sort of peculiar irony that attracted Nolan to the story when he initially conceived of the project in the mid-90s, while sailing across the English Channel along the evacuation route with his wife and producing partner Emma Thomas. He envisioned an immersive experience that expanded upon the war genre's rather simplistic emotional dynamics, with a wider range of color, thus achieving a different kind of reverence towards Dunkirk's participants. The idea stayed with Nolan through these subsequent decades, even as his career exploded into the stratosphere following the breakout success of films like Memento and Batman Begins. After the completion in 2014 of his sprawling space epic Interstellar, Nolan finally felt he had accumulated enough experience and artistic clout to tackle Dunkirk as his next feature-length project. Admittedly, this is something of an absurd sentiment on its face. How could the director of gigantic films like the Dark Knight trilogy, Inception, and Interstellar not feel ready or experienced enough to helm a $100 million film about a real-world event? One only needs to look at the finished product to see the answer lies not in Nolan's confidence towards his technical mastery, but rather in the amount of creative goodwill he needed in order to take so experimental a tack with such an expensive effort. Indeed, Dunkirk stands as something of a culmination of the many artistic strands that Nolan had been perfecting throughout his career, and only now was it possible for him to tie these strands together into a cohesive, singular experience. Here was a director at the apex of both his technical powers and his cultural relevance, empowered to make whatever he wanted at whatever scale he wanted, thanks to a long-standing relationship with Warner Brothers that had reached the rarefied era of total creative trust and financial backing previously reserved for such heavyweights as Stanley Kubrick, Alfred Hitchcock, or even Cecil B. DeMille. Their partnership had been so fruitful that, at this point, he could have asked for $100 million to direct an adaptation of The Phone Book, and they would have cut a check in the room. Thankfully for the studio, and for audiences, it wasn't The Phone Book that Nolan wanted to direct, but rather a compelling minimalist story about courage under unrelenting fire that would showcase the director's staggering technical prowess while pushing his artistic inclinations in bold, new directions.
Right between our rear guard and the French, we're holding the line. And the enemy tanks have stopped.
Why have they stopped?
Waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel.
They're not stopping here. We need to get our army back. Britain's next, and then the rest of the world.
Christ. In retelling the story of Dunkirk, Nolan couldn't escape the fact that the event was technically a retreat. At this point in the war in 1940, Axis forces had taken so much of France that the Allies felt their best course of action was to pull back and regroup for a better defense against the Nazis' inevitable attack on the British homeland. In the small coastal town of Dunkirk, close to the Belgian border, this evacuation was met with relentless assault by well-supplied German forces, intent on decimating their numbers before they could set foot off the European continent. Having cultivated an effective cross-cutting technique throughout his previous work, Nolan desired to employ it towards the whole of a feature-length narrative, in effect creating one long note of sustained suspense that he described as the story of immediate tension in the present tense. Right away, this suggested that the director would have to eschew his tendencies towards increasingly inflated runtimes and zero in on the most concise, succinct version of the narrative at hand. Indeed, at an hour and 45 minutes, Dunkirk is Nolan's shortest feature film since Following. The film is split up into three distinct planes of action: the air, the sea, and the ground, referred to in the film as the mole, so named after the dock jutting out from the beach. Each of these separate strands duck and weave through each other, only to converge at the end as the battle reaches a fever pitch. Dunkirk takes a decentralized approach to its plot, trashing the idea of a singular protagonist in favor of enigmatic figureheads, fictional composites instead of historical accounts. They have names, to be sure, but we as an audience don't have the luxury of time to learn them when our very survival is at stake. I say our survival because Nolan intends for these characters to simply serve as windows through which audiences can immerse themselves in the sweep of history as it actively unfolds. We never see beyond this limited subjective perspective. We're stuck with the Allied forces on the ground, forced to flee with them as chaos and destruction surrounds us. We rarely even see the attackers, save for the occasional German fighter plane. In casting Dunkirk, Nolan mostly ignores his reputation as a director of prestigious Academy Award-nominated talent in favor of casting young unknowns like Finn Whitehead, who anchors the mole sequences as the boyish and doggedly determined grunt Tommy, so named not for a specific person, but for the era's slang term for a rank-and-file British soldier. Whitehead's story is one of sheer survival, desperately grabbing for any toehold to safety like a rat fleeing a flood.
What's wrong with your friend? He's looking for a quick way out. In case we go down.
One of his companions in this regard is a fellow soldier named Alex, played by world-renowned pop singer Harry Styles in his first major acting role. Interestingly enough, Nolan reportedly wasn't aware of Styles' fame at the time, having thought he had cast a young unknown off the strength of his talents like he had done for Whitehead. Styles nevertheless proves more than capable, readily eschewing any pretense of rock star glamour or vanity in order to fit in with the desperation and grit that surrounds him. The sea-based sequences illustrate one of England's crowning moments of the entire war, in which a small fleet of civilian pleasure cruisers sailed across the English Channel and directly into harm's way to help evacuate their countrymen in uniform.
Greatest plane ever built!
Even look.
Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. Sweetest sound you could hear out here.
Dunkirk zeroes in on the journey of the Moonstone, a tiny boat captained by Mark Rylance's Mr. Dawson. He courageously charts a treacherous course to Dunkirk with both his son and his son's best friend in tow, only to find himself in a contained chamber drama when he picks up a lone, PTSD-riddled soldier caught adrift in open water. Played by longtime Nolan collaborator Cillian Murphy, the shivering soldier, as he's credited in the titles, is hell-bent on getting back to England, and his combative response to Dawson's insistence on keeping the course leads to drama just as unpredictable and dangerous as the battle they're sailing into. The last third of Dunkirk's triptych of narratives finds Tom Hardy as a hyper-focused RAF pilot named Ferrier, expertly blasting German fighter planes out of the sky in his Spitfire. That is, until he runs low on fuel and risks having to ditch out behind enemy lines.
Forward this leader, one bandit down. Forward this leader, do you read?
Another member of Nolan's loyal repertoire of performers, Hardy was no doubt selected in part because of his uniquely expressive eyes, an absolute necessity when the character's face must be hidden behind a bulky flight mask for the majority of the picture. Hardy had previously accomplished this same task for Nolan as the menacing masked brute Bane in 2012's The Dark Knight Rises, and achieves in Dunkirk a similar effect, albeit one that's better calibrated to his character's stoic heroism. It's also in Hardy's storyline that one finds the film's most cleverly disguised cameo, Michael Caine, who just barely manages to add another link in his unbroken chain of successive performances for Nolan dating back to Batman Begins, by lending his iconic voice to the role of an officer dispatching commands over the two-way radio.
Stay down at 500 feet to leave fuel for 40-minute fighting time over Dunkirk.
Understood. Vector 128 Angels Point 5.
And keep an eye on that gauge, even when it gets lively.
Out of a cast of literally hundreds, Jack Lowden, Barry Keoghan, Tom Glenn Carney and fellow director Kenneth Branagh deliver standout performances, with Branagh's turn as Commander Bolton serving as a particularly compelling reminder of the dignified composure exhibited by the Allied brass, even as the world was falling down around them.
You can practically see it from here.
What?
Home.
With Interstellar, Nolan borrowed liberally from the Steven Spielberg School of Filmmaking, adopting several of his predecessor's stylistic affectations to imbue the unknowable majesty of space and our cosmic connectivity with a sense of overwhelming wonder and awe. Spielberg has similarly influenced the war genre, with his 1998 classic Saving Private Ryan providing the aesthetic and emotional benchmark for subsequent war pictures to follow. While Dunkirk shares inevitable similarities to Saving Private Ryan in a stylistic sense, Nolan charts his own course, fashioning a visceral experience that speaks to his own impeccable technical pedigree, as well as his desire to reinvent the visual language of whatever genre he is working in. This is evident in the initial references he drew inspiration from. One might expect to see a list of iconic war films, but Nolan draws from a wider, diversified pool of sources. All Quiet on the Western Front and the Battle of Algiers appropriately conveyed the chaos of battle to his collaborators, but other works like The Wages of Fear, Alien, Speed, Foreign Correspondent, and Sunrise asserted themselves as genre exercises in sustained suspense or unique applications of montage. Sunrise, a 1927 silent classic by German director F.W. Murnau, proved to be a key reference for Dunkirk, with the narrative challenges inherent in the absence of sound demonstrated for the benefit of the film's ambitions as an almost exclusively visual work. Towards this end, Nolan also looked to the influence of other silent-era directors like Cecil B. DeMille for his handling of epic spectacle and large crowds. Dunkirk retains the stark, austere visuals that Nolan is known for, adopting his signature metal and earth tone color palette, while photochemically boiling his chromatic spectrum down to a limited range of cold blues, teals, and grays. The gloomy daylight that hangs over the English Channel takes on a creamy tinge as it provides the key light for a naturalistic yet foreboding presentation. It's only a matter of time until Nolan succeeds in making an entire picture with large format photography like IMAX, and Dunkirk naturally represents Nolan's most ambitious effort to date towards that goal. Working once again with his interstellar cinematographer Hoyte van Hoytema, Nolan uses conventional 35mm celluloid film only when he has to, most notably in dialogue-intensive scenes that take place in cramped quarters like the Moonstone's cabin below deck. For the vast majority of Dunkirk, about 70 to 75% of the finished product, Nolan and Hoytema use a blend of large-format 65mm and IMAX film. While this approach retains the abrupt, somewhat jarring shifts of aspect ratio between the CinemaScope 35mm and the larger full-frame gauges, Dunkirk's visceral command of its massive scale keeps the audience fully immersed with a minimum of distraction. Nolan captures this overwhelming, all-consuming chaos with his signature epic flair, blending majestic classical camera work with urgent handheld photography that ably evokes the war as hell tonality of Saving Private Ryan, while still asserting an aesthetic character all its own. Nolan's love of aerial photography works particularly well in this regard, bringing a seasoned and enthusiastic energy to Dunkirk's Dramamine-necessitating dogfight sequences. The film, as a whole, naturally acts as the latest showcase of Nolan's advocacy for the supremacy of celluloid's organic grit over digital's glossy sheen, putting the format's resiliency to the test many times over. One particular instance would involve the loss of an IMAX camera when the plane it was mounted to accidentally sunk to the bottom of the sea. While the camera was, understandably, toast, the film inside was not. Indeed, the hardy archival qualities of celluloid meant that not only was the footage usable, it was pristine. While the film is stuffed to the brim with the epic spectacle we've come to expect from Nolan's filmography, there's also a curious tonal intimacy at play, a touch of the avant-garde that allows Dunkirk to function as both a compelling dramatization of a historical event, as well as an abstract meditation on industrial-scale survival. The bulk of Dunkirk was shot in the locations where these events actually happened, most notably on the very same beach where soldiers lined up to board evacuation boats as German bombs fell around them. Nolan's longtime production designer Nathan Crowley even rebuilt the mole from the original blueprints. Even when the production moved to the waters off of Holland, or a water tank in Los Angeles for select sequences, the crew dedicated themselves to historical accuracy in the details, right down to the last steel rivet. At the same time, his treatment of landscape reduces his backdrops to two planes of action, above and below. The shared horizon line that bisects his frame ties the mole, sea, and air narratives together with thematic uniformity, but it also has the effect of abstractifying the action into an interior realm. This impression goes a long way towards explaining why Nolan felt the need to accumulate more experience and clout before embarking on production. Especially within the calculated cynicism of today's studio climate, he wouldn't have been able to make Dunkirk as the impressionistic survival and courage allegory that he did, at the level of production value he did, and with a mostly young and unknown cast, unless he himself was the brand that guaranteed a healthy return on investment. It takes a great deal of experience and confidence to underdevelop his characters in the manner he does here. It goes against every artistic grain in our bodies, indeed everything we've been taught about writing story. However, Nolan recognized that the Battle of Dunkirk was a much bigger story than any one person, and that the most effective version of any film recreation would be the one that captured the shared humanity of its participants while installing key avatars through which the audience could immerse itself fully and share in the experience. This is something that cinema does better than almost any other established or emerging medium, and Nolan recognizes this. It's why he eschews cheap gimmickry like 3D in favor of large film formats that quite literally fill the audience's field of view. It's why he avoids the uncanny plastic sheen of digital and embraces the organic warmth and texture of celluloid. True immersion demands as few barriers between the image and the audience as possible, and Dunkirk succeeds in this regard due to Nolan's artistic precision as well as the subtle abstract touch he brings to the proceedings. Nowhere is Nolan's avant-garde touch more evident than Dunkirk's original score, composed by longtime music collaborator Hans Zimmer in partnership with Benjamin Wallfisch and Lorne Balfe, among others. Zimmer and Wallfisch's foreboding suite of cues are anything but subtle, evoking the dark belly of the military-industrial beast that was World War II. Limited melodies compete for air against an expressive industrial texture, with an arrangement of string and brass instruments manipulated so as to recall the alarming whine of an approaching fighter plane, or the listless whir of a ship engine as it teeters onto its side. Simply put, the score is an unrelenting juggernaut of abstract musicality, made all the more intense by Zimmer's deployment of the Shepard tone, an auditory illusion that Zimmer previously used a similar effect on The Prestige and in the Joker's theme for The Dark Knight, wherein a sense of escalating danger is implied by a tone whose pitch seems to escalate towards infinity without breaking. The effect is one of squirming tension on the part of the listener, an auditory twisting of the knife that corkscrews the anxious feeling in our stomachs, like waiting for the beat to drop at a rave in hell. As he did previously on Interstellar, Zimmer also synthesizes the sound of Nolan's ticking pocket watch and lays it down as a bedrock of Dunkirk's score. As if the music wasn't intense enough, the tick-tick-tick sound of time literally dripping away amplifies the desperate intensity of Dunkirk's tone while conveying to the audience just how close the world came to an Axis occupation of the United Kingdom, if it hadn't been for the courageous spirit and dogged resistance of its people. Indeed, time, the device of the ticking clock, unifies the thematic whole of Dunkirk, placing the film as an exploratory apex within Nolan's career. Again, the story essentially functions as one large escape sequence. In the capable hands of Nolan's longtime editor Lee Smith, this exercise in narrative minimalism becomes another form in which Nolan can actively manipulate the bounds, indeed the very shape, of time itself. Since his very first feature, Nolan has actively utilized cinema's unique ability to convey sophisticated storytelling through non-linear structure. His primary tool in this regard is the crosscut, which he's employed throughout his filmography to tremendous effect. Whereas Nolan's previous films tend to use the crosscut to add emotional heft to key narrative sequences, Dunkirk basically functions as a feature-length string of crosscuts. Rather than numbing his audience to its effects, Nolan instead seems to reach a new level of complexity and sophistication with his approach to montage here. Each component of the story's organizational triptych, the mole, the sea, and the air, takes place over a different time span, a week, a day, and 1 hour, respectively. By dovetailing these sequences into each other as one seemingly continuous event, Nolan effortlessly compresses and expands time at will. Admittedly, this is a rather large leap of artistic license on Nolan's part, especially when so much attention is otherwise paid to historical accuracy within the frame. But Nolan's approach nonetheless captures the harrowing emotional truth of the battle. The fractured chronological presentation also allows the story to revisit key moments from earlier in the film, revealing different perspectives that deepen our understanding of the big picture. One such moment is the scene where Ferrier's co-pilot ditches into the sea. From Ferrier's perspective in the air, it looks like a stable, almost peaceful water landing. Assured of his colleague's safety, Ferrier jets off to another part of the battle. From his co-pilot's perspective, however, it's a very different story. Beyond the rattling impact of the crash landing, the cabin quickly fills up with water, and he can't open the glass cockpit to escape. Dunkirk is filled with moments like these, moments that convey a complex, dueling subjectivity that amplifies as the various timelines intersect and collide with each other. Nolan's creative subversion of chronology is easily the most visible signifier of his authorship, but is far from the only one. Dunkirk abounds with displays of Nolan's secondary artistic signatures, like his fascination with functional style as embodied in the military uniform seen throughout, or Ferrier's on-the-fly calculations about his fuel consumption, pointing to the director's use of math and physics as a storytelling tool. However, what immediately sets Dunkirk apart from other films of its ilk is the sheer weight of the picture. Nolan's previous films all boast a visceral heft to their impact, a palpable gravity to match their monumental ambitions. This impression is due in large part to Nolan's dogged insistence on practical, old-fashioned filmmaking that demands everything that can be captured in camera will be captured in camera. Famously averse to the reliance on CGI that stains the films of some of his contemporaries, Nolan commands an intimidating array of practical resources that give Dunkirk its distinct feeling of inescapable danger. Make no mistake, the ability to make a film at this scale with the resources he demands is a luxury, a direct benefit of his status as a certified moneymaker and pop culture icon. Fortunately, Nolan makes these demands always in service to his story, and not his vanity. Dunkirk finds Nolan's deployment of practical effects reaching new levels of challenge, necessitating the director to alter how he conducted his own set in order to create a truly immersive environment for the audience. For instance, he went so far as to have members of his own crew dress up in the military costumes worn by the extras, so that they could hide in plain sight within the frame as he shot in all directions. He also incorporated old-school techniques to amplify the size of his crowds. Whereas now one can simply copy and paste any number of digital extras into a scene, he and his crew went to the trouble of creating detailed cardboard cutouts of soldiers to put in the far distance of wide shots on the beach. This pursuit of the analog over the digital permeates Dunkirk, creating no shortage of technical challenges for his crew, like, how exactly does one mount an IMAX camera to a vintage fighter plane? We should know the answer by now. By quite literally bolting the camera mount to the wing of a specially modified plane, attaching some specialty periscope lenses, and taking that sucker up into the air. Dunkirk's aerial dogfighting sequences boast some of the film's most gripping moments. We can quite literally feel the G-forces pulling on our gut as we bank, roll, and dive with Ferrier's Spitfire. A substantial portion of these scenes were actually shot up in the air, with the actors in the cockpit. Most filmmakers of Nolan's ilk would be happy to throw up a mock cockpit in front of a green screen and call it a day, but his insistence on in-camera visual effects makes for footage that drips with hyper-realism. In Nolan's hands, the mounted camera becomes a powerful tool for visual storytelling, generating intense POV shots as well as the kind of surreal images that only cinema can conjure. A standout shot finds the camera mounted sideways to the deck of a ship as it rolls over towards the water. But since the deck is fixed to a stationary point within the frame, the sea appears to coalesce into an intimidating wall of water that rises up to swallow the boat whole. In a filmography devoted to the study of heroes in action, Dunkirk offers a very different portrait of heroism. An earnest, quiet courage and hopeful resilience that stands in stark contrast to the theatrical superheroics of the Dark Knight trilogy. In this way, Dunkirk represents something so much more than the director's latest technical tour de force. Rather, it represents an evolution, an artistic maturation of an intensely cerebral filmmaker at the peak of his powers. Despite possessing the monumental scope and big-budget pyrotechnics we've come to expect from Nolan, Dunkirk's confidence to experiment with narrative structure and concise abstraction makes for an unexpectedly intimate and personal experience. It is, in essence, an art film masquerading as summer blockbuster. The reception to Dunkirk's theatrical release would reconcile these competing halves of the film's psyche, with prominent critics like The Hollywood Reporter's Todd McCarthy hailing it as an impressionist masterpiece, and audiences flocking in droves to make it the highest-grossing World War II film of all time, generating $500 million in worldwide box office receipts. A slew of accolades would single out Dunkirk for its direction, score, and cinematography come awards season, culminating in 8 Oscar nominations in the categories of Best Picture, Best Director, Best Cinematography, Best Production Design, Best Original Score, Best Sound Design, and Best Sound Mixing. Nolan's nomination for directing comes after a long series of snubs by the Academy. Indeed, the director's rabid fan base has repeatedly railed against the Oscars' failure to recognize his considerable achievements in directing since The Dark Knight. To finally break through with Dunkirk seems rather appropriate, considering its unique ambitions and the considerable challenges Nolan set for himself in making the film. Regardless of its award season success, Dunkirk stands as yet another major achievement in Nolan's intimidating filmography. Its very existence illustrates that, after a lengthy string of mega-successful blockbusters, Nolan seems intent on exploring beyond conventional narrative structures and presentations in order to find some kind of intimate yet universal emotional truth, a subversive purity that uses modern visual grammar to reinforce timeless artistic ideals. In a time where critics and audiences alike conflate movies with television, and vice versa, as one indistinguishable medium, Nolan's lifelong quest to preserve the sanctity of the movie house and extol its superiority to the home theater has never been more urgent. Dunkirk is nothing less than a shot across the bow, a slap upside the head that compels us to remember what makes the communal moviegoing experience such a special one. For all his pop culture significance and ambitious storytelling, Dunkirk reinforces the idea that Nolan's greatest legacy of all may be as the man who dedicated his life to saving the movies, wielding his considerable clout with industry suits and mainstream audiences alike to show that thought-provoking, challenging cinema can be a universal language that is accessible and enjoyable to all. Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.